The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Shelley Lawrence from the Division of Neonatology at the University of Utah with us this month. Welcome back, Shelley.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks,
Paul. As I mentioned at the end of last week's episode, it feels in some ways like we're in a period where diseases that we have sort of thought as historical artifacts make sure that we remember that they're not artifacts, that they're still an issue. And so we wanted to talk this week about ophthalmia neonatorum, which, as I frequently point out to my patients, that many diagnoses sound like Harry Potter curses. And this is one particularly bad curse. Are you ready to talk about this?
I am. And it's actually such a pleasure to be here talking about this because, you know, actually looking at the history and getting some data can be really important, and I've learned a lot.
No, good. Before we proceed, would you like to talk about your disclosures?
Yes, I just have a single disclosure that I'm a co-founder of a startup company that's commercializing a device for broad pathogen detection in neonates, but it in no way interferes with our discussion today.
Terrific. So, you know, I think we both went into the weeds a little bit on this one. I went into the historical weeds on this, partly because I'm fascinated by a lot of things, and I'm a very distractible person, but I think history is interesting. And I think that public health is fascinating because I think there are things that we have taken for granted that have resulted from public health that we really don't appreciate enough. So I want to share just a little bit of what I learned there. So prophylaxis for gonococcal ophthalmia neonatorum began before the antibiotic era, which I think is fascinating. That this is a great name, Carl Sigmund Franz Kreder in Leipzig in 1880, that up to 40% of all blindness in Germany was caused by gonorrheal ophthalmia neonatorum. And by starting to put silver nitrate drops in babies' eyes when they were born, that incidence decreased to zero, that it just went away. And that is a staggering fact in my mind.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, this is one of those public health measures that really created positive change. And again, we talked about this just a little bit, you and I, that because people today don't know where we came from, it's really easy to refuse certain interventions that we might have that in the past has really revolutionized public health and talks about how needed it is. But just because we don't see it anymore doesn't mean it's gone away.
Right, exactly. Simple things. Vitamin K, there's increasing resistance to vitamin K at time of delivery, increasing resistance to vaccines of all types. And to be absolutely honest, I'm not sure I understand it completely. I don't know where the mistrust has increased. I'm certainly interested to know that, but I don't completely understand it.
Yeah, and I wonder too, when these diseases, because they will all come around when herd immunity, you know, is no longer protecting us, it'll make me wonder if it'll change again people's perspective of vaccinations. But I too feel like practicing in today's world, it's harder to be a doctor in the world of mistrust, and people believe what you read on the internet more than you believe, you know, a very seasoned, skilled physician. Yes.
I think it has become increasingly difficult to figure out how dependable a source of information is, that a lot of things get equal weight that maybe shouldn't get equal weight. Anyway, in the wake of Dr. Kreder's bold experiment, most industrialized countries actually have had a legally enforced mandate. Utah has, the Utah Code requires that we do prophylaxis for ophthalmia neonatorum. And the latest version of the code that I found with either silver nitrate, erythromycin or tetracycline, but actually erythromycin is the only one that's licensed in the U.S., right?
That is correct. And I will point out that it says every physician or midwife practicing obstetrics or midwifery shall, within 3 hours of birth of a child instill or cause to be instilled in each eye medication.
And I would just want to take one more aside. One of the things that I think, and there's probably some relationship of this to many things that we do with infants, and that's how effective is targeted screening? That by history that we can say this is the person who is or isn't going to need eye prophylaxis.
Yeah, I think the problem with a risk-based approach is physicians are usually not provided the time to go back and do such a thorough history to try to get the actual risk. My opinion is any woman who shows up who's pregnant is obviously sexually active, unless you know everybody's history of, you know, even if you have a partner and it's only a single partner, well, who's your partner been with? And are they honest about who they've been with? Like, once you show up and you have a baby, you're sexually active, that makes you at risk because you're obviously sexually active and you can get these diseases if you're with the right person.
Right, right. And given the fact that these are difficult diseases to track sometimes, it's very difficult then. And given the emotional freight that goes with complete veracity in a relationship, it's fraught. This freight is fraught, apparently.
Yes, I agree. I think that the risk-based approach is not one that should ever be adopted. But luckily, we have a screening approach that's supposed to be 100% all pregnant women that is effective. And so that's what we should focus on.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about gonorrhea. Is the incidence of gonorrhea changing as like syphilis is?
So chlamydia and gonorrhea are interesting when we compare it to syphilis. So as far as gonorrhea, the cases are increasing from its historic low in 2009. And so the latest report is a rate of about 179 cases per 1,000 population in 2019. Now that's about an 83% over the 2009 data. But for the rates in men and women are just a little bit different. So in men, gonorrhea is increasing more than it is in women over the, you know, 2020 to 2021 period. So it was twice as many men got gonorrhea during that time period than women. But if we look over the last 10 years, the rate of gonorrhea in women has increased about 65%. Chlamydia, on the other hand, has decreased over the last 10 years, 1.6%. So those numbers are a little bit interesting because usually we associate co-infection of chlamydia and gonorrhea together, and about a third of women who have gonorrhea will also have chlamydia. So it's interesting that one is decreasing while yet another one is increasing.
So it's whack-a-mole. It's a moving target.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Agreed.
So the transmission of gonorrhea is different, though, than the transmission of syphilis, correct? The route of transmission is different?
That is correct. So gonorrhea is not transmitted in the placenta like syphilis is. Gonorrhea is an infection that usually will ascend from the infected cervix. And even if you have an intact membrane in your uterus, it can transcend that. So even babies that are born by a C-section without rupture membranes can still be at risk for this if the mother has a gonorrhea infection. But for babies to get gonorrhea, the mom is usually infected, and it's obtained at the time of birth. And when we're talking about, you know, eye disease, if mom has gonorrhea, then about half of those women are going to have babies that are going to have eye disease that do not get prophylaxis.
What does gonorrheal conjunctivitis look like?
So it usually happens about 2 to 5 days after birth, and it is usually a purulent discharge in the affected eye, and usually both eyes can be affected. So even with prophylaxis, 10% of neonates that are exposed to gonorrhea will potentially develop gonococcal conjunctivitis. But usually it starts with a purulent discharge, the eye becomes swollen. But if this becomes systemic, then the babies can really get sick with meningitis and sepsis like pitcher, even including arthritis, where they don't want to move their joints.
And again, you say this, it occurs at 2 to 5 days. And so a lot of these babies will have gone home.
Correct. Yes. So many of the diseases we're talking about is not necessarily something that I might see as a neonatologist, But pediatricians really need to be aware because this will affect them.
And what's the natural history of untreated gonococcal ophthalmia neonatorum?
So the problem is if that conjunctivitis isn't treated, it can actually erode the cornea and can cause a rupture and lead to blindness. So it can be pretty devastating.
And is that the route for disseminated infection, or is the route for disseminated infection other?
So when we're talking about the eye disease, you know, the eye has an optic nerve that goes directly into the brain. And so anything that infects that orbit has the risk and potential to cause meningitis. The other thing is babies' immune response is generally not as well prepared as older patients and adults, that organism can become disseminated in the blood just because there's a local infection. It can gain entry into the bloodstream and go wherever it, you know, travels in the bloodstream once it makes its way there.
How's the diagnosis established?
So there is a lot of good tests that we can test for any type of eye disease. There's a lot of what we call nucleic acid-based testing, or PCR is probably the best way people know these things. Many hospitals and laboratories have developed their own PCR kits that can test for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and some other types of organisms that might affect that eye. Now, those are rapid detection tests that can be used, but it will only test for what's in that assay. So generally, a eye culture is done. And then once that culture grows out, then you can use some of these PCR-based testing mechanisms. Or let me just say this. You can start with a PCR test or grow it out. The culture is what is most accurate, more sensitive, because not only can you grow out the organism, but you can also determine its sensitivity to treatment.
What is the treatment?
So for gonococcal disease, it's going to be ceftriaxone is going to be the treatment. Usually it's a 25 to 50 milligram per kilo dose in a single dose, not to exceed a total ceftriaxone dose of 250 milligrams.
You mentioned prophylaxis is supposed to be administered within 3 hours of delivery. If appropriate prophylaxis has not been administered and the baby's parent has tested positive, what's the treatment there? Or what can I do?
So you can give a prophylactic dose, and this is what's recommended, to give that dose of ceftriaxone to the baby. Ceftriaxone, though, does have some safety issues, particularly in babies that might be in a hospital, particularly if they're getting calcium-containing IV fluids. So cefotaxime is also recommended, but this needs a little bit of an asterisk, too, because cefotaxime has also been difficult to obtain because of shortages. So some hospitals have cefotaxime, some don't. With ceftriaxone, it's just important not to administer this drug in the same line that you might have calcium-containing IV fluids. And if your baby is at risk for jaundice because, let's say, of, you know, ABO incompatibility or whatever, you just need to monitor bilirubin levels very closely because it can also cause bilirubin levels to rise by displacing it from albumin. So there's just a few things. It's not an unsafe drug. It's just some things that you just need to follow a little more closely.
Now, if a mother has tested positive for gonococcus, should the baby be treated then with anything more than prophylaxis? Should that baby also receive a dose of ceftriaxone or cefotaxime?
So here it's going to be, like you said, getting in the weeds. So if mom's had time to finish appropriate treatment and get a test of cure where she's no longer positive, then just if she's treated with an appropriate test of cure, and it's just the routine eye ointment at birth. However, if she comes in and she's had no prenatal care and she has signs that, you know, they go ahead and they test her for gonorrhea and or chlamydia, and she's positive for gonorrhea, it's better to treat that baby because of the high incidence of eye disease and other problems that can relate to that. So in that case, it's better to give the ceftriaxone.
Keeping in mind that, as you pointed out before, that unlike syphilis, that the timing here is critical because it's perinatally transmitted. And so even with intact membranes, but still it's likely to be at the time of delivery as opposed to months before.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. especially because the baby's passing through that purulent discharge if they're a normal birthing process as they're being introduced to the world.
I pointed out the historical change wrought by eye prophylaxis. Is that something that we also see currently, that eye prophylaxis continues to eliminate gonococcal ophthalmia neonatorum?
So I would say yes. Gonococcus is becoming a little more resistant to many of our first line antibiotics. But right now, the CDC still recommends that all babies get erythromycin eye ointment. Now, erythromycin eye ointment is not protective for chlamydial conjunctivitis, which can occur usually around 2 weeks of age. And that's usually how the distinction is made between gonorrhea and chlamydia. But gonorrhea is the one that really gets your attention because of just how virulent that organism is and the amount of injury to the orbit that you can get. There are, though, because of the shortage in erythromycin, it kind of makes you want to go back and look at the history of eye prophylaxis as well as what other countries do. And because screening is so well established in places that have good health care, as far as universal health care, many places have stopped recommending eye prophylaxis because the numbers are just so small of the babies that actually come back and have problems. So, you know, I think that in this day and age, you know, there's a discussion to be had when we have screening techniques. And if mom is really positive, it might be that a different course is necessary.
As you've just pointed out, as of winter 2024, there is at least a relative shortage of erythromycin eye ointment, which could become worse before it becomes better. This going along, of course, with the bicillin shortage that you talked about in the last couple of weeks and shortages in several places. Given an impending shortage, what's a nice pediatrician to do?
Well, so if you read the Red Book, they recommend that you might also consider azithromycin 1% ophthalmic drops. I will say there is a pay difference, though, between the two. If we look at how much that erythromycin cost, it's about $2 per ampule. Now, the erythromycin ointment is about $105 per 2.5 ml.
Azithromycin.
Vial. Azithromycin, 1% yeah. Ophthalmic. Yeah, it's $105. That's a big cost. Yes. I don't think that's going to be used.
I'm not a superb mathematician, but I have the impression that's a lot more.
Yes. And that was really the only numbers. As you know, it's very hard to find the cost of things, and the cost of things can differ if you do or do not have insurance. But I think that's probably a fair representation of the cost difference. So I think with the erythromycin shortage, it's really going to stress to our OB counterparts the importance of screening all the women. And if there's no prenatal care, making sure they all get screened when they come in to deliver, so that if the mom has gonorrhea, that we can treat that with that dose of ceftriaxone and then monitor that kid very closely to make sure that there's no eye disease that develops.
Given the shift in epidemiology of syphilis, are there any changes that would seem to make sense in terms of timing of screening? A lot of screening is done early in gestation. Should screening happen more than once for these diseases?
So particularly with syphilis, we are really trying to get OB providers to do three-point testing during pregnancy. That's in the earliest appointment or first trimester at 28 weeks and again at birth. Some of that is because if mom has the earliest stages, she's not going to present on her blood test to show a positive screen. But if we can, and even with gonorrhea, if we do multiple points of screening during pregnancy, then at each point we have the ability to intervene in mom's care to treat both her and baby. I will say that even if a mom, let's say she was screened at 28 weeks, found to be syphilis positive and could be treated before the baby was born and they both went home happy and healthy, you know, by 24 to 48 hours, that saved that baby a minimum of $20,000 from being in the NICU or the newborn nursery for 10 days to get bicillin, needing potentially a PICC line and being separated from the mom to get that treatment. So we should never think that not doing these screens and treating the baby is an appropriate course of action.
Excellent advice. And again, to be clear, the erythromycin ointment is not necessarily preventative of chlamydial conjunctivitis.
That is correct.
And so the advantage there is primarily gonococcal.
You are correct. Yes. With chlamydia, that's a little bit harder organism because the drug that we have to treat that, erythromycin, has also been associated with a condition called pyloric stenosis in infants. Mm-hmm. So we could be, you know, treating one potential condition at the expense of creating a whole other issue. So if we look at chlamydia, though, it is the most common infectious disease cause of conjunctivitis. And it does cause up to about 3% of the world's blindness. So when we talk about chlamydia, this is truly a subset of kids that really does need close follow-up. Because unlike Neisseria, you know, we think we prevent this eye disease from erythromycin, but we know now it doesn't work with chlamydia. So if mom does have chlamydia without a test of cure, then we really need to follow these infants for the first couple of weeks really closely, because even if they don't get conjunctivitis, 10 to 20% might get pneumonia later on.
Mm-hmm. And if 2 weeks in we see chlamydia conjunctivitis, how would you diagnose that? How would you treat it?
Yeah, so unlike gonococcal conjunctivitis, that really is a very purulent kind of get your attention in the physical exam. Chlamydia can kind of start as a watery discharge. The conjunctiva might be red. Many cases are even mild or self-limited, but if you have a progressive chlamydial eye infection, then you're going to start to get eyelid swelling. You're going to start to potentially get a pseudomembrane formation on the eye. You might start getting more corneal involvement. Like, it will get to a point where it's going to grab your attention.
Okay. And how would you treat that?
So with chlamydia, what's recommended is erythromycin, 50 milligrams per kilo, divided into four doses, and you give it for 14 days. And this is not only for oral. Yeah, it's not just for the conjunctivitis, but let's say they were also to get pneumonia. That would be the treatment of choice.
Okay. It sounds like this is an area with some room for change in practice, if by no other means than more assistance with prenatal care.
Agreed. And I do think that it really does make us want to have a conversation about people who do deny both vitamin K and erythromycin. I mean, I hate to say it, I've had conversations with families like, listen, I know you don't want the erythromycin, but can we circle back to the vitamin K? Mm-hmm. Now, why do I think vitamin K is more important than, you know, the erythromycin? Other than in my line of work, I rarely see gonococcal ophthalmia. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But when I have seen a couple of cases of kids that have missed vitamin K prophylaxis,
right,
and the ones that survive is just, they're devastated with the amount of internal bleeding. So I don't know why I would compromise one over the other. Although I think just having truly a conversation with families, particularly when it comes to gonococcal ophthalmia, that, you know, ensuring that, well, if you don't want this treatment, can we screen? If you don't want the screens, these are the things you need to look for in your infant and make sure that they can come for follow-up care if those symptoms present.
Yeah, and I think clearly there's some power in being able to discuss that intelligently with people, because I think that there's a very large subset that is at least amenable to having a conversation.
I agree with you. And, you know, if you're willing to compromise on some of these things, you know, like if you talk to them about vitamin K, but they still don't want erythromycin, you know, acknowledge that the parents have made a decision and just, again, sit down, you know, okay, well, if this is your decision, then just know if these things show up, we really like to see your kiddo again. The one I will stress with parents, though, is once that bleeding happens, the cat's out of the bag. It's hard to get on top of that, at least if there's, you know, a beginnings of an eye infection. I feel like, you know, even though there's a risk of blindness, it's a much different risk.
Right. Well, Shelley, this has been very illuminating. I feel a lot smarter after talking to you. That's a great skill you have. Thanks for spending the time the last few weeks. We'll hope to have you back in a week to answer some questions. I hope you're willing to do that. Anything else you want to share on either of these topics?
I will just say again that your colleagues are always here to help. the neonatology group at the University of Utah, as well as the ID folks. We're always here to answer your questions and to make sure that we help guide you through any questions that you might have. So please send us any of your questions. We're here to all be collaborative.
So what collaboration's all about? Well, very helpful information. We'll look forward to talking to you with some questions related to these topics in a week or so. And this has been a delight. Thanks to Lisa Stoddard for making this sound like a podcast. Thanks, Janice, for listening. And we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds great, Paul. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.